by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass makes heaven the middle of it. Grass makes heaven the middle. We are grass makes heaven.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a very good program this weekend. There's a lot going on. We're just 3 to 4 days away from the election, Sunday, Monday, 2 days, rest of today, 2.5 days from the election. It's going to be the most important election this century for sure. And we've got to return President Trump for 4 more years in the White House. He just come back today. He's in Pennsylvania, but yesterday he was in the upper Midwest. And we're going to have a clip with Laura Ingraham later on. But right now, we're going to play a clip of Tucker Carlson interviewing Miranda Devine, who broke the story on the laptop. Okay? And then also we have a interview that Laura conducted with the laptop attorney. And we're going to expand that and fill in some of the blanks here. So we're going to start off with this interview that Tucker had on Fox News Network with Miranda Devine, and she broke this story, and the news, social news agencies and all the high tech have totally covered it up, and it's created a scandal. It's going to come back to bite them. So here we go with Tucker and Miranda Devine.
Well, for 5 years, we have watched the news media treat Donald Trump in a way that no American president has ever been treated. Richard Nixon himself, disgraced, impeached, forced from office in the end, got a pass by comparison to Donald Trump. Reporters hate Trump with an all-consuming mania. They hate him so intensely that at times it's been amusing to watch. If Donald Trump announced a cure for cancer at tonight's rally in Minnesota, CNN would denounce him for fixing drug prices. That's true. If you're a fair-minded person, it has been infuriating to watch this. It's too dishonest. It's also patronizing, because it's almost unbelievably stupid. Trump spied for Russia! Trump works for Putin! Trump's a racist because he likes borders and doesn't want to live in Haiti! Yeah, okay. Clearly all the smart kids went into finance. America's websites and TV stations got the rest. Unfortunately, we've got to live with the consequences of that. But we should also say, if we're being entirely honest, that as grating as all of this is, unremitting hostility to the President of the United States is far from the greatest threat America faces. Reporters are supposed to be tough on people with power. That's why we have journalism, to keep a close eye on those who have outsized influence over our lives. The people we should watch carefully would include business moguls, the intel agencies, prominent academics, cultural figures, military leaders, and most obviously our politicians. The rest of us can't really know what these people, the people in charge, are doing at all times. A reporter's job is to find out and tell us. So in the end, the real threat to America isn't too many nasty questions from reporters. It's the opposite of that. The real threat is collusion. When journalists strike secret alliances with the very people they're supposed to be holding accountable, we are in deep trouble. Lies go unchallenged. Democracy cannot function. And that's what we're watching right now. Yesterday, and this may be the starkest example of all, we learned that the FBI is conducting an active investigation into Joe Biden's son for business deals that apparently included his father, the former vice president. Now, that is not speculation. It is confirmed. Former Biden business partner Tony Bobulinski sat for a 5-hour interview with 6 FBI agents just the other day, a week ago. They asked him about his business dealings in China with the Biden family. Now, we don't know if this investigation will result in indictments, obviously. We know that it could. And that's significant because Joe Biden, as you may have heard, is running for president. The election is on Tuesday. So by any possible measure, this is a blockbuster, Stop the Press's news story. It's not some naughty picture from somebody's laptop. This is a criminal investigation into business deals that we know for a fact Joe Biden was party to. So why haven't you heard more about this? If you don't watch this channel, you've likely heard nothing at all, not a word. And you know why. Because the media are collaborating. They're collaborating with the Democratic Party. They're collaborating with the intelligence agencies that spy on Americans with impunity. They're collaborating with the tech monopolies that have choked off the average person's access to legitimate information. We're not overstating any of that. We wish we were. Watch the people you're supposed to be able to trust dismiss a completely legitimate, verified news story as, quote, a Russian plot.
Holding super spreader events and giving Russian disinformation, spreading Russian disinformation.
Disinformation that he knows to be fabricated and supplied by a foreign intelligence service. And despite the warning, he's still doing it.
You have said this entire thing is so obviously a Russian plot.
It's sort of a crazy quilt at this point, which has all the hallmarks of Russian disinformation. That said, it wasn't for lack of trying.
Rudy basically functioning as a Russian asset by pushing Russian disinformation.
CNN reported on Friday that U.S. authorities are seeing if those emails we just talked about are connected to an ongoing Russian disinformation effort. Huh.
I've got to tell you, Keith, it has all the hallmarks of Russian disinformation. These people wouldn't know Russian disinformation if it got into the shower with them. They know nothing. Every word of what they just said was a lie. Russia didn't forge these emails. Vladimir Putin didn't invent the two separate meetings that Tony Bobulinski had with Joe Biden to discuss business in China, the business the FBI is now investigating in an active criminal investigation. That's all entirely real. It happened. It is happening now. And the people you just watched on the screen know that it did. Yet they're telling you it's all fake, a concoction of a hostile foreign power. So you have to ask yourself at some point, why would they tell you that? They know it's not true. They're saying it anyway. They're expecting you to believe it. Why are they doing that? Well, because these people are not your allies. They're not trying to help you or inform you. Just the opposite. These people are your enemies. They are misleading you so that you will obey. And maybe it'll work, honestly. Maybe they will get Joe Biden elected president next week without even asking the most basic questions of the candidate, the most basic questions, or vetting him in any way. That could work. That's the gambit. But what then? Many of these people you just saw on the screen will then go to work for Biden officially. We'd expect that because without Donald Trump to hyperventilate over, the business models at many news outlets will collapse and these people will need jobs. But Joe Biden and Kamala Harris can't hire everyone at NBC. Some of these people have to continue to be, quote, journalists. And the question is, can they really do that? Can they keep pretending on your screen live every night after everything we have just witnessed? The New York Post's Miranda Devine joins us tonight for the latest on what is, again, a real story. Miranda, it's good to see you tonight. Tell us what we know.
You too. Well, look, we have continually, every single day, we have the liberal media colluding with big tech and the intelligence agencies to cover up a story about Joe Biden, which shows that he is corrupt or has been corrupt. And the evidence has piled up. You've reported, you did the interview with Tony Bobulinski. We reported at the New York Post on the material that was on Hunter Biden's laptop. It all points to Joe Biden's involvement in his family's influence peddling scheme in China and Ukraine and other countries. Now, this is a legitimate story. We've had nothing from Joe Biden because, of course, he doesn't have to answer these allegations. He doesn't answer any questions because he's not being asked. And because the rest of the media is running interference for him. They're accusing us, the New York Post, and you as well, I guess, and Tony Bobulinski, of being agents of Russia and peddling Russian disinformation. And I just think this is not journalism. And any journalist who is complicit in this cover-up, this corrupt cover-up, just ought to resign.
I saw an anchor at CNN on social media call for the New York Post to erase its stories off social media. call for the New York Post to become complicit in its own censorship. I never thought I would live to the age where a news anchor, a journalist, a reporter would say something like that. What do you make of it?
Well, that's Jake Tapper. So the New York Post, we were locked out for 2 weeks by Twitter. Only tonight has Twitter been kind enough to let us have our account back. But for 2 weeks, we were held hostage by Jack Dorsey, the head of Twitter, who said that we could only get our account back if we deleted the tweets pointing to our stories about Hunter Biden's laptop. There was nothing inaccurate in those tweets. There was nothing inaccurate in the stories. The stories were not hacked material, as everyone now admits. Initially, we were locked out because Twitter said we had violated their hacked material rules. They then accepted we hadn't, but they wouldn't unlock us until we deleted those completely blameless tweets. And so we refused to do that because we have integrity and honour. And Jake Tapper obviously has other ideas. He said that we could have just made it all go away and we could have had our account back if we just deleted the tweets and then did what Twitter wanted, and then we could retweet something else afterwards, which is so pathetic. You know, that tells you that the rest of the media is not aware of the danger of censorship from these all-powerful organizations that control the channels of information that we all use.
Yep.
And, you know, the proof of that is that now more than half of Americans think that the Hunter Biden laptop story is Russian disinformation. So it's worked. And this is right before an election campaign. Real evidence of corruption that points to Joe Biden being involved in this influence peddling scheme, making millions of dollars with his family out of selling out this country to China in particular and to Ukraine. And yet that's been covered up by the media and censored by big tech. And other journalists think that's okay.
Yeah, just lie. Just betray your conscience. Just go along with what they want you to do. Mouth the words, and we'll give you your social media account back. It's Orwellian. Miranda Devine, great to see you tonight. Thank you so much.
Next, we have Laura Ingraham interviewing the attorney that represents on this laptop scandal. We're going to elaborate a little bit more on that. Laura Ingraham interviews the attorney that's representing, okay, Brian Della Rocca, that's actually representing John Paul McIsaac, the man that actually was a repairman of this laptop that was finally discovered to be Hunter Biden's. So anyway, we've got an interview here with Laura Ingraham and the attorney representing the repairman, and here's what he has to say about his interactions, the repairman, with the FBI and so forth. So here we go now.
Now, we all know about Hunter Biden's laptop and the damning emails exposing the Biden family's seedy business deals. But what about the computer repair shop owner who first brought it to light? Well, that man is named John Paul McIsaac. His lawyer will be here in moments with some shocking claims, but first, the backstory. Now, according to Isaac's attorney, a man claiming to be Hunter Biden dropped his laptop for repairs in April of 2019, but he never came back to pick it up. Now, after news broke of Hunter's Ukraine dealings in July of 2019, Isaac was concerned that Hunter's computer held files that were pertinent to an investigation, so he and his father decided to notify the FBI. Well, the FBI finally got back to the Isaacs in October of 2019. 2 months later, the FBI seized the laptop and all relevant documents, but not before Isaac copied the hard drive out of what his attorney calls an abundance of caution. Now, over the course of the impeachment trial in early 2020, Isaac apparently wondered why no one ever referenced the fact that the FBI had Hunter's laptop. So he tried blowing the whistle to a member of Congress, but was ignored. Now, finally, in September 2020, after he had exhausted all his options, Isaac reached out to Rudy Giuliani's office. Joining me now is Brian Della Rocca, Isaac's personal attorney. Brian, Now, why did the FBI wait until Trump's impeachment to reach back out? Did you ever find out?
Well, I can't answer that question for you, Laura, but I can tell you that my client was very frustrated by the way the FBI treated him and his father. They came to the FBI really wanting to provide them with information that could be relevant to their investigation. And instead of taking the information, they turned them away. And so that was frustrating. And they did not come back to them for another few months. And at that point, they finally delivered a subpoena to John Paul, and he gave up the computer. He didn't need the subpoena. He would have done it anyway.
Brian, this is what Congressman Adam Schiff had to say after the Hunter Biden laptop story broke. All right, Brian. Well, he basically alleged that your client is a Russian agent, that he basically, the smear comes from the Kremlin. Is your client a Russian agent?
My client couldn't be anything further from a Russian agent. Unfortunately, this is what's happening today. My client did the right thing. He turned in information that he thought might be relevant to an investigation that was going on, and was essentially thrown under the bus. He's a private citizen. He's a great American. And instead of looking at what he has, people just started calling him a Russian agent, saying he was part of some Russian disinformation campaign, and he couldn't be further from that. He comes from a long line of military veterans. His father is a colonel, a retired colonel in the U.S. Air Force, and a Vietnam veteran, and he would never do anything to hurt this country.
I have a question, Brian. When they say that laptop was dropped off by someone who claimed to be Hunter Biden, do they have any video surveillance stored of who comes in and out of the store? Can you back it up to the time where the computer was turned in or no?
It's my understanding that the feed does not stay around for too long. So it records, it is recorded over eventually. But we have other ways we have confirmed that it's Hunter Biden's laptop.
And why did he feel the need to make a copy of the hard drive? And do you think that was ethical? I got about 15 seconds.
Well, honestly, look at what's happened. He was doing it because he has seen other people go through this type of a situation, and he just wanted to protect himself. So what we are doing is we are working with a computer forensics expert to make sure that if anyone says that this is wrong, that he lied, we can show them.
All right, Brian, we're going to have to bring you back because this is a wild story. We have a big celebration coming up. Stay there.
Next, we have Ted Cruz. Questioning Jack Dorsey, head of Twitter, and he actually says that what they do when they censor or knock someone off has no effect, will have no effect on the election. This is preposterous and absurd, and Ted Cruz couldn't believe what Jack Dorsey was saying. Here we go next.
Chairman, I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for holding this hearing. The three witnesses we have before this committee today collectively pose, I believe, the single greatest threat to free speech in America and the greatest threat we have to free and fair elections. Yesterday, I spent a considerable amount of time speaking with both Mr. Zuckerberg and Mr. Pichai. I have concerns about the behavior of both of their companies. I would note that Facebook is at the minimum at least trying to make some efforts in the direction of defending free speech. I appreciate their doing so. Google, I agree with the concerns that Senator Klobuchar raised. I think Google has more power than any company on the face of the planet. And the antitrust concerns are real. The impact of Google is profound. And I expect we will have continued and ongoing discussions about Google's abuse of that power and its willingness to manipulate search outcomes to influence and change election results. But today, I want to focus my questioning on Mr. Dorsey and on Twitter. Because of the three players before us, I think Twitter's conduct has by far been the most egregious. Mr. Dorsey, does Twitter have the ability to influence elections?
No.
You don't believe Twitter has any ability to influence elections?
No, we are one part of a spectrum of communication channels that people have.
So you're testifying to this committee right now that Twitter, when it silences people, when it censors people, when it blocks political speech, that has no impact on elections?
People have choice of other communication channels with which...
Not if they don't hear information. If you don't think you have the power to influence elections, why do you block anything?
Well, we have policies that are focused on making sure that more voices on the platform are possible. We see a lot of abuse and harassment, which ends up silencing people and having them leave from the platform.
All right, Mr. Dorsey, I find your opening questions, your opening answers absurd on their face. But let's talk about the last 2 weeks in particular. As you know, I have long been concerned about Twitter's pattern of censoring and silencing individual Americans with whom Twitter disagrees. But 2 weeks ago, Twitter and to a lesser extent Facebook crossed a threshold that is fundamental in our country. 2 weeks ago, Twitter made the unilateral decision to censor the New York Post in a series of two blockbuster articles, both alleging evidence of corruption against Joe Biden, the first concerning Ukraine, the second concerning communist China. And Twitter made the decision, number one, to prevent users, any user, from sharing those stories. And number two, you went even further and blocked the New York Post from sharing on Twitter its own reporting. Why did Twitter make the decision to censor the New York Post?
We had a hack materials policy that we...
When was that policy adopted?
In 2018, I believe.
In 2018. Go ahead. What was the policy?
So the policy is around limiting the spread of materials that are hacked. We didn't want Twitter to be a distributor for hack materials. We found that the New York Post, because it showed the direct materials, screenshots of the direct materials, and it was unclear how those were attained, that it fell under this policy. Now,
so in your view, if it's unclear the source of a document, and in this instance, the New York Post documented what it said the source was, which it said it was a laptop owned by Hunter Biden that had been turned into a repair store. So they weren't hiding what they claimed to be the source. Is it your position that Twitter, when you can't tell the source, blocks press stories?
No, not at all. Our team made a fast decision. The enforcement action, however, of blocking URLs, both in tweets and in DM, in direct messages, we believe was incorrect, and we changed it.
Today, right now, the New York Post is still blocked from tweeting 2 weeks later.
Yes, they have to log into their account, which they can do at this minute, delete the original tweet, which fell under our original enforcement actions, and they can tweet the exact same material in the exact same article, and it would go through.
So, Mr. Dorsey, your ability is you have the power to force a media outlet. Let's be clear. The New York Post isn't just some random guy tweeting. The New York Post has the fourth highest circulation of any newspaper in America. The New York Post is over 200 years old. The New York Post was founded by Alexander Hamilton, and your position is that you can sit in Silicon Valley and demand of the media that you can tell them what stories they can publish, and you can tell the American people what reporting they can hear. Is that right?
No. This was every person, every account, organization that signs up to Twitter agrees to a terms of service.
So media outlets must genuflect and obey your dictates if they wish to be able to communicate with readers. Is that right?
No, not at all. We recognize an error in this policy, and specifically the enforcement.
You're still blocking their posts. You're still blocking their posts. Right now, today, you're blocking their posts.
We're not blocking the posts. Anyone can tweet.
Can the New York Post post on their Twitter account?
If they go into their account.
No is your answer to that. No. Unless they genuflect and agree with your dictates. Let me ask you something. You claimed it was because of a hacked materials policy. I find that facially highly dubious and clearly employed in a deeply partial way. Did Twitter block the distribution of the New York Times' story a few weeks ago that purported to be based on copies of President Trump's tax returns?
We didn't find that a violation of our terms of service and this policy in particular, because it was reporting about the material. It wasn't distributing the material.
Okay, well, that's actually not true. They posted what they purported to be original source materials, and federal law, federal statute makes it a crime, a federal felony, to distribute someone's tax returns against their knowledge. So that material was based on something that was distributed in violation of federal law, and yet Twitter gleefully allowed people to circulate that. But when the article was critical of Joe Biden, Twitter engaged in rampant censorship and silencing.
And again, we recognized errors in that policy. We changed it within 24 hours. This is.
But you're still watching the New York Post. You haven't changed it.
We have changed it. They can log into their account, delete the original tweet.
You forced a Politico reporter to take down his post about the New York Post as well. Is that correct?
Within that 24-hour period, yes. But we, you know, as the policy has changed, anyone can tweet.
So Twitter takes the view you can censor the New York Post, you can censor Politico, presumably you can censor the New York Times or any other media outlet. Mr. Dorsey, who the hell elected you and put you in charge of what the media are allowed to report and what the American people are allowed to hear? And why do you persist in behaving as a Democratic super PAC, silencing views to the contrary of your political beliefs?
Let's give Mr. Dorsey a few seconds to answer that, and then we'll have to conclude this segment.
Well, we're not doing that. And this is why I opened this hearing with calls for more transparency. We realize we need to earn trust more. We realize that more accountability is needed to show our intentions and to show the outcomes.
Thank you, Senator.
So I hear the concerns and acknowledge them, but we want to fix it with more transparency.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. The ranking member.
These people, these social network, high tech, they call them, are beginning by their allocating, either controlling the search engine results, or knocking out people totally off their services, you know, where you can't find them there and they no longer have a voice. Yes, it does affect the elections. And coming up next, we have an interview just recently, yesterday, Tucker Carlson interviews Dr. Robert Epstein. And he came up with the idea of search engine manipulation effect. And here's what he has to say about the effect that they can have on millions of voters. And by just manipulating the results, and they have over 600 people that are monitoring these different search engines. And here's what Robert Epstein had to say, interviewed by Tucker Carlson. Here we go next.
When I first heard someone suggest years ago that the big tech companies, now the monopolies, might intervene on behalf of a candidate in an American election, it seemed far-fetched. Now it's obvious that is happening. There's no question about it. So far, the tech monopolies have censored reporting on the Biden's family business practices. They've silenced politicians they don't like. They've deplatformed any user who deviates from a narrowly prescribed set of approved ideas. And they also have other less obvious ways to influence the election. Google can offer biased search suggestions, and does. YouTube gets to pick the next video that you watch. What's the effect of all of this? Much more profound than anything any foreign country is doing to us. Dr. Robert Epstein has been studying tech and its effect on politics for years. He's expressed concern about the power of tech monopolies on this show. He did it 2 years ago.
And I can tell you that we should be paranoid, because what Google and Facebook can do is really mind-boggling. If Mark Zuckerberg on election day last year, if he had chosen to press the enter key early morning and just sent out a message to Hillary Clinton supporters only saying, go out and vote, a go out and vote reminder, that would have sent her an additional 450,000 voters that day, with no one knowing that this had occurred.
So when you control all the information, you control what people know and what they believe. You control people's minds. What's the practical effect of that control 4 days out from a presidential election? And is there anything we can do about it? Dr. Robert Epstein joins us tonight. We're happy that he is. Doctor, thanks so much for coming on. So first to the practical effects. What do you think big tech's interference will do to the election results?
Well, based on the data that we're collecting, I would say that if what we're seeing is present nationwide, they are probably shifting this year, in this election, about 15 million votes without anyone's awareness and, except for what I'm doing, without leaving a paper trail for authorities to trace.
How are they doing that?
They're doing it with bias in search results, which basically no one can see. It'll be very tough to see. We've been measuring that now with about 600 field agents in the swing states, and just based on the first 150,000 searches that we've looked at, and that's about 1.5 million search results and over a million web pages, we're finding very substantial pro-liberal bias in all 10 or at least 9 out of 10 search results on the first page of Google search results, strong liberal bias, not on Bing or Yahoo, though. And we're seeing that bias in every single demographic group. In fact, in one report we generated recently, we saw more liberal bias in Google content going to conservatives than going to liberals.
Interesting. So that is the definition of propaganda. They're tailoring information to change the views of people in a very targeted way. Now, it's obviously immoral. It's election interference. Is it legal? I mean, we have campaign finance laws, don't we?
Well, you know, there are no specific laws or regulations in place stopping a company from like Google from doing something like this. In fact, the courts have basically over and over again said they can exercise their free speech rights and show people anything they want to show people. But yes, indeed, you could look at this as an extreme violation of campaign finance laws. In effect, they're making huge in-kind donations, huge.
Yes.
To one party or one candidate. Now, it doesn't cost them a dime, but that's not the issue. The issue is, what would it cost you to do it, or what would it cost me to do it? And we're talking tens of millions of dollars at least.
One of the reasons this is so corrosive is because it's so difficult to measure, and it makes everybody paranoid and distrustful and undermines confidence in the system because you can't see it, as you said. How do we measure this? How do we prevent a replay of this, not just to stop helping Democrats, not for partisan reasons, but for the sake of our collective confidence in our system?
I think there's only one way to do it. I don't think laws and regulations can keep up with tech. I've been in touch with a lot of members of Congress, a lot of AGs. They're all very frustrated. I think we do it with monitoring systems, with large-scale Nielsen-type monitoring systems. As I say, we have more than 600 field agents this year in the swing states. We'll probably have 700 or 800 by the election day. And what happens in that case is, with their permission, we're using software to look over their shoulders and see what these tech companies, Google, Bing, Yahoo, Facebook, and more, see what these tech companies are showing them. Real people. They have to be real people. Republicans, Democrats, Independents. And we aggregate that data, and we look for shenanigans. We look for targeted messages. We look for bias. And we're doing it on a massive scale, and we're preserving that information. I think that's how you defend democracy.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. They must hate you, and that's a badge of honor.
I'm sure.
Dr. Robert Epstein, thank you for coming on tonight. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's Robert Epstein. Robert Epstein is saying that, yes, right now, those search engines and these big tech, social network, you could say companies, are providing a bias to the liberal left, Democratic left side in this election. Right now, he's saying that. And he's saying before the election, they'll have They have about 600 people monitoring these sites now, and they'll have up to 700 to 800, I think is what he said earlier. But I've been tracking him, and we had previous programs on this over a year ago when he first started coming out with this SEME, search engine manipulation effect. And this should have been picked up by Trump people way back. They're really slow in getting on top of this. They should have had a mechanism already, like he's expressing, for the future already set up and 6-8 months ago on this, but they didn't. I suggested that a year ago. But anyway, I'm just one small man in a great big world. But so here we go, here we go. Coming up next is Laura Ingraham. She was traveling with the president, and I've been watching the president speak. He's got four stops in Pennsylvania today. They're overflowing crowd. Thousands of people are turning out to see him. And this is what Laura Ingraham encountered yesterday in the upper, you could say, Midwest through Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. And there were big crowds that turned out. And at one point, the Minnesota Walls, Minnesota government, governor, you know, choked down to 250 people that could get in this hangar, which they've allowed thousands before in different states. And so the people were mad as hell at their governor in Minnesota. And people are turning out. They're saying that we like freedom. We don't. This lockdown is against us, is going against us, and it's harming us, and we want to be free. So anyway, this is Laura Ingraham's report. Yesterday, she was following the president, and she has some really good things to say. Here we go now with Laura Ingraham.
From Minneapolis tonight, with just 4 days until the election, President Trump is kicking his campaign into overdrive, crisscrossing the country, holding multiple rallies in crucial states. And today was a three-state sprint across the upper Midwest. And I was lucky enough to tag along for each leg of the ride. Almost didn't make it to the studio tonight. It was wild. The whirlwind tour started in Waterford Township, about 40 miles north of Detroit in Michigan. Now, this is a heavily Democrat county that Hillary Clinton won by more than 8 points in 2016. But today, you would have sworn that this was the heart of MAGA country.
For years, you had a president who apologized for America. Now you have a president who is standing up for America and standing up for the great people of Michigan.
Here we are in Michigan. The crowd is a hearty crowd. Look at them. They're still up there. They've been here, some of them, since 6 a.m. It's about 10 degrees with a wind chill. But nobody's leaving. The president's still speaking. You can see him in the background there.
We didn't care about elections before Trump. Now we care. We care a lot. We have to have Trump. We love Trump.
We love him. We love him. We're keeping him. We're keeping him for four more years.
When we win, Michigan wins. When we win, America wins. And that's what I want. That's all I want.
Why are you supporting Trump?
He's a candidate for life, and he supports Christians, especially Chaldean Christians. We love you, President Trump.
And he's a candidate for America.
Catholics for Trump. My parents came here 40 years ago from Iraq legally, and we support Donald J. Trump.
Why do you like Trump?
He followed through on all of his promises.
Does that mean he's a real politician?
We love that he's not.
Now, even in near freezing temperatures, you couldn't sense that anything but excitement and energy was in the air. But Joe Biden was on the trail at the same time as Trump's Michigan rally, and he, too, was making his final plea to the voters, though I'm not sure his closing message made a lot of sense.
I'll mobilize a true international effort to stop China's abuses.
Yikes. Okay. Well, back to President Trump. After the first rally ended, we packed up, boarded Air Force Two on our way to Air Force One is a smaller plane, on the way to Green Bay, Wisconsin. Now, right off the flight, I caught up with the commander-in-chief for just a quick temperature check.
In Green Bay, Wisconsin, look at this crowd. It's massive. What does it make you feel like?
It's very exciting. There's a lot of love, and we look forward to it, Laura. It's great to have you.
All right. We look forward to it.
Now, that message of confidence and trust in the people of Wisconsin was echoed by his chief of staff, Mark Meadows.
What do you think? You're going to take Wisconsin again?
We're going to take Wisconsin. If the people of Wisconsin vote their values, vote their prosperity, they're going to vote for Donald J. Trump. Unbelievable crowd, unbelievable day. And here's what we also know. If you go around this crowd, these are hardworking Americans. They're the people that do the vast majority of the living and dying in our country. And quite frankly, they're the ones that matter most. And so we're here to ask them for their vote and ultimately hopefully bring it home on November 3rd.
Now, the iconic football city of Green Bay is nestled in a county that Trump won by nearly 11 points in 2016. And Trump's appearance here was clearly a call to action. And he even got a boost from a Packers legend.
I also want to thank a legendary champion and a Green Bay Packer personified Hall of Famer, Brett Favre, for his endorsement. He's a tough guy. He's great. But 2 days ago, I saw that he endorsed me, and I just want to thank him. He's a hell of a champion.
But it wasn't just the famous people, the faces. The folks in Wisconsin are clear-eyed about what they want, and it's a second Trump term.
So the biggest applause lines were taking on China, getting back to our normal lives after COVID, and jobs, keeping jobs in this country. I think here in Wisconsin, it's all about the economy.
All right, girls, why are you here?
President Trump.
Why? Why not Joe Biden?
Sleepy Joe? I'm sorry, I can't. The president, who doesn't even know what he's talking about, I can't. We are the president that gets things done.
If you can believe it, after his second marathon rally of the day, the president made his way to Rochester, Minnesota. Now, the story at that event was the disgusting and frankly transparent effort by Democratic leaders here in this state to limit Trump's fans from coming out to see him. They capped the event at 250. Now, this is outdoors at an airport. Okay. Now, while Governor Tim Walz and Attorney General Keith Ellison, they did their best to try to blunt the president's momentum. Guess what? Didn't work.
These are the people who were not allowed by Governor Walz to actually enter the rally. Look at how long ago these people were not allowed to come in. So the president actually came out to see them.
What a moment. Now, after losing this once deep blue state to Hillary Clinton by about a point and a half in 2016, President Trump is looking to close the deal in a state that has not gone Republican, as he said a couple of times today, since 1972. Now, based on the enthusiasm that I saw there tonight, I would not bet against him. And I know I'm going out there on a limb, but this was unbelievable. The polls have Trump behind in all three of the states he campaigned in today. But are they missing something? Now, they certainly don't seem to capture what I saw at the rallies. And maybe it's just anecdotal, but I've been in politics for 30 years. I've never seen anything like this. Never. Not for Obama, not Clinton, not Bush, and not even President Reagan. Just have never seen anything like it. Now, you felt this way before, too. I know some of you did 4 years ago. And I can tell you that, again, based on what I'm seeing, if you had to ask me, had to gun to my head, I'd have to say it felt like 2016 all over again.
The momentum is building. They're coming down to a thing that says a consensus of opinion of different forecasters that Pennsylvania is going to be the keystone state that will decide the election. But my impressions after watching all of these different rallies and so forth and so on, is that I believe what they're doing is most analysts are looking at this interactive map and clicking here and there and saying about the Electoral College votes. I think 3 to 4 previous all Democratic states are going to be flipped to red. I think that the upper Midwest, he'll win or 2 or 3 of those states. Pennsylvania may be still in contention, but I don't think in the end, we've got a lot of Latinos that are going to come over and cross over the aisle and vote for Trump. And in an extraordinarily high level number of blacks are woken up. They're woke now to what Trump is all about and how he's helped them. They're going to come across the aisle and vote for Trump also. So I believe about three states that were previously Democratic states are going to be flipped. He'll hold normally the states that are forecast for him. And then Pennsylvania won't matter at all. I don't think it's going to be a factor. If they're going to use that, they plan to use that and hold out those votes for 3 to 5, 7 days and then run those votes in and make that the deciding state. I think he'll have 270 easily without Pennsylvania. So that's my forecast now. And it's so exciting. Now we're going to end the program with about 15 minutes of the Bob Alinsky interview that Tucker Carlson had of the man that verified Tucker's involvement with the Russians and so forth. We're going to wish y'all good luck and God bless each and every one of you. We're just going to end with the program and the music. Thank you.
We just showed you the first 20 minutes of our interview a few hours ago with Tony Bob Alinsky, well-known international businessman who was asked by the Biden family to do business with them in China. He met with the former Vice President Joe Biden 2 separate times, and they talked about the China business deal. Now, this information has been out for several weeks. It's been in the hands of a number of different news organizations. The reason you're hearing a lot of this for the first time tonight on this show is because they have resolutely ignored it and tried to suppress the story. Joe Biden has rarely been asked about it, though there is an enormous amount of detail and documentation that no one has refuted because it's real. This topic did come up because the president pushed it at last week's presidential debate. And what was notable was that Joe Biden didn't deny any specifics about his connections to the Chinese Communist Party, his family doing business there, he himself participating in that business. Instead, Biden dismissed the entire story out of hand and suggested that Tony Bob Alinsky, who is a veteran, a former naval officer, was part of a Russian disinformation campaign aimed at this country. His evidence for that? Well, there wasn't any. Instead, he cited a letter from, quote, 50 former national intelligence folks, almost all of them partisans, every one of them a liar. None of them had directly assessed the information. Not one of them called Tony Bob Alinsky. They knew nothing. Joe Biden said that on stage. And so when we spoke to Tony Bob Alinsky, we asked him his reaction to that. And here's what he said. Tell me about the conversation that you had with Joe Biden. What did he say to you?
You mean the morning after he spoke?
That's right.
There was 10 people running around, getting him something to drink, and we were backstage in a cramped space. And he asked me to walk with him out to the car. And he just asked, you know, how I did and what I thought of his speech. And I thought he did a great job in the speech. And obviously cancer is a very serious thing that we should all be working together to solve. I just lost a sister-in-law within the last 2 weeks, sadly, to cancer. And and then he just sort of asked me to keep an eye on his son and his brother. Yeah.
What do you think he meant by that?
I think it was conscious of things, and, you know, I can't speak for him.
Maybe
I would love for him to go on record. You know, as I referenced earlier, I'm only sitting here because they have not only have they not gone on record, they've denied it, and they've tarred my family name and a long history of serving this country, and have other congressmen now talking about Russian disinformation.
This whole smear on Joe Biden comes from the Kremlin.
I held a top secret clearance from the NSA and the DOE. I served this country for 4 years in one of the most elite environments in the world, Naval Nuclear Power Training Command. And to have a congressman out there speaking about Russian disinformation, or Joe Biden at a public debate referencing Russian disinformation, when he knows he sat face-to-face with me, that I was traveled around the world with his son and his brother, to say that and associate that with my name is absolutely disgusting to me.
did you complain about that? I mean, to suggest that you were committing treason or a part of a foreign attack on our democracy, which is how they characterized it. I mean, that's such a serious and I think unfair charge. Did you bring this up with them?
Well, in basic form, you're exactly right. They are publicly accusing me of treason right now, treating me like I'm insignificant, or the 50 years of history that my family served this country is insignificant, and that's why I'm sitting here having this. I assure you this is the absolute last place I want to be right now and the last thing I want to be doing right now. But I feel like I have a patriotic duty to this country and every American citizen to go on record and define the facts for them and let them do their own work. Let them decide how they view those facts or not. But for the Biden family to deny these facts and then not only deny them, they could have just said no comment, but they didn't say no comment. They then brought in Russian disinformation and basically associated my name with that, which is absolutely disgusting to me. And I had to go on the record. Last weekend, I was in Virginia. Sadly, my sister-in-law passed away at around, I think, 6:38 Saturday morning. That's the wife of my brother who spent 28 years serving this country as a naval flight officer and just retired. So you can imagine me dealing with that and the tragedy of that. When I saw Adam Schiff go on record talking about Russian disinformation after this email had been posted online by the New York Post, and remember that email was to me from James Gillier, right? It wasn't, you know, I wasn't blind carboned or CC'd on that. It was to me stating that I was going to be the CEO of this enterprise. I was at the end of my rope. And so I crawled Rob Walker. And I told him that if that statement isn't retracted by Congressman Schiff by midnight on Sunday, that I was going on record and I was disclosing all the facts to the American government, to the American citizen, and the world. I was hoping the Bidens would do the right thing or Schiff would retract his statement. But I could not allow another minute, another hour, or day for my family's name to be associated or muddied up around Russian disinformation. So even as I sit here today, I would ask the Biden family to come on record and stop using my name or associating it with Russian disinformation. It's absolutely disgusting.
So this is Rob Walker, the representative of the Biden family. I believe his wife worked for the Biden family, apparently. So you said this to him. I won't go public. I just want them to retract the accusation that I'm an instrument of Russian disinformation. What did he say?
That's correct. Rob is under a tremendous amount of stress.
Right.
Obviously, he's a wife and a child. And he said, listen, let me make some calls. Let me call George, who's Hunter Biden's lawyer, and see what I can do. But he sort of presented it as if that's going to be impossible for me to get done. And, you know, I'm not naive. I know that's not impossible to do. That's a single phone call from Joe Biden to Adam Schiff saying, basically, go on record and retract your statement. You got over your skis. And when I, you know, I was up late that night, and when the statement wasn't retracted, come Monday morning, I was ready to go on record. And how that record was, I was willing to go in front of any senator, any congressman, the Department of Justice, the FBI, or sit here with you, Tucker, and basically provide the facts to the American people and let them make their decision. This isn't a political focus of mine. People were accusing my family of treason after I served this country and defended this country.
So the reason you wound up here in this interview, and I just want to affirm for our audience, I don't think you had any desire to do this interview.
Absolutely no desire.
Is because nobody else told your story. So were you surprised, given the trove of documents you have, given the credibility that I think is apparent that you have, that no other news organization took the time to unpack this story?
Surprised is probably an understatement of the year. Shocked, because it would be different if this was my word against Jim Biden, Hunter Biden, and Joe Biden.
Right.
That would be a very slippery slope. Not something I would take the personal and family risk on it. But I've provided more documents and facts that validate times, meetings, who participated. That email to me on May 13th was generated by somebody else sent to me. It wasn't me generating. These text messages that I've provided are Hunter Biden in the first person, Jim Biden in the first person, James Gillier in the first person, Rob Walker in the first person. It's not me generating the text messages. It's them speaking. So you can interview them. The FBI can interview them. Our government can interview them. But I was shocked that not only the media is not only discussing this, they're going to the other extreme. They're dismissing it as Russian disinformation. This country has heard enough about Russia. We went through 3 years of every day, Russia, Russia, Russia. It's just absurd. The Cold War is over.
And they're saying it about your family.
Yes.
The Biden family knew that you're going public with this. And you spoke to Rob Walker about it. Again, the self-described Biden family representative. And Biden family, meaning Joe Biden as well. What was his response when you let him know that you were going public with this?
Trying to coach me. Trying to sort of say, hey, we don't want to do that. We don't want, you know, press trucks out in front of our house. I'm going to have to move. I could lose my job. All that, I'm not trying to cause any harm to anyone in this situation,
right,
let alone Rob Walker and his family, James Gillier and his family. But basically Rob's position was, if you go on record with all these facts, you'll bury all of us.
If he doesn't come out on record, I am providing the facts.
Tony, you're just going to just bury all of us, man.
What was your response to that?
I was focused on pushing these guys to do the right thing, to demonstrate an ounce of integrity in front of the American people. They all know the facts. I live the facts. And luckily for the American people, all the facts are extremely well documented. I'm irrelevant in this discussion, so I can write off, but the American people can read these texts, listen to the recording that you just played, read the legal documents that were executed in Delaware, and they can form their own conclusion. They don't need me to form the conclusion for them.
Give us a sense of your contacts with Hunter Biden. A lot of this is complex. There's a lot that we're not, and this is television, so we're not putting, you know, everything that we have on the screen,
right,
because we can't. But for those who might suspect that you didn't really have a lot of contact with Hunter Biden, give us a sense of some of the places where you had conversations with him,
yeah,
and over what time frame.
So obviously, as we already discussed, throughout 2015 and 2016, while Joe was still the sitting vice president of the United States, these guys had been doing extensive work around the world in places like Oman, Luxembourg, Romania, that I was being made aware of, but I obviously hadn't come off the bench and agreed to be part of this.
I'm sorry, I've got to interrupt you there. Oman, Luxembourg, Romania.
Correct.
So they don't speak any of these languages. Neither one of these guys has any record of success in business. Neither one has a background in international business. Why would they be doing business in Oman, Luxembourg, and Romania?
Because they have relationships and they have the Biden name that they're able to set up meetings and get people to jump through hoops in an interest to garner favor with the sitting vice president, Joe Biden.
So it sounds like Gillier is a legitimate business guy, someone who's
yes,
fluent in the language of
yes,
international
James
business.
Gillier, you know, served his country. He's British.
Yes.
He's traveled around the world for decades. He's a very low-profile
right,
individual. But he is he's sharp, and he's as legitimate as they come.
Sounds it. But Hunter Biden and Jim Biden have a well-documented, decades-long record of business disasters. Did you get any sense that either one of these guys was qualified to be conducting this kind of business?
The only qualification they had was the Biden name.
But they seem to have parlayed that into quite a few deals in quite a few countries. And I interrupted you. So give me, continue with where they were doing these deals.
Yeah, so you had asked, you know, the extent of my communication with Hunter Biden. So when I decided to come off the bench and entertain being the CEO of Sinohawk Holdings, obviously, I was brought up to speed on the work that they had been doing in Oman, Luxembourg, France, Romania, Kazakhstan, and stuff like that.
Thank you for listening, and God bless each and every one of you. Good night.